The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Trump and an actual toddler, this is an analogy, it breaks down at some point. And the reason it breaks down is that toddlers grow up. They're behaving the way they're behaving because they have limited cognitive capacities to deal with the world. And so if they pitch a fit, it's their way of trying to signal what's going on. Trump, believe it or not, despite the nature of the threat, I don't think is going to grow into the presidency.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 1st, 2020. Yes, it's April Fool's Day. And normally under these circumstances, we would defraud you with some prank podcast, but we're not going to do that today. Instead, we're going to do something amusing and real. Joining me remotely in the virtual jungle studio is Daniel Dresner, professor at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and the author of two rather remarkable political science books. One on zombie apocalypses and international relations theory, and a new book on the president as a toddler. These books are not jokes, at least they're not entirely jokes. They are serious pieces of political science. They're also really funny, and they're both, in different ways, highly relevant to the situation we face today as a society. Dresner and I talked about how zombies are like coronavirus and how they're different. We talked about whether international relations theory correctly anticipates how governments will respond to crises, and we talked about Dresner's epic Twitter thread on the toddler-in-chief. It's the Lawfare Podcast special bonus edition, Dan Dresner on zombies, viruses, and toddlers. Dan, you have a new book out on a matter of great interest to me personally, but also to, I suspect, a lot of Lawfare readers and listeners. But before we get to your new book on the toddler-in-chief and this epic Twitter thread that you have put together over the life of the Trump presidency, I want to talk to you first about an old book of yours.
But one that you can't kill.
Exactly. It's a book you can't kill, although it can kill you. You wrote a book a few years ago about the zombie apocalypse and international relations theory that just seems relevant to the current environment. Coronavirus being something like a zombie apocalypse. So tell us about your book and how it relates to the current post-apocalyptic hellscape that we're living in.
Sure. So the book that you're referring to is the very directly titled Theories of International Politics and Zombies, which the first edition came out in 2011. The revived edition came out in 2014. And the book asks the very, very important question, what would different theories of international relations predict would happen if, in fact, the dead started rising from the grave and feasted upon the living? And in writing the book, you know, which was intended to do two things. First, mildly tweak my own profession, or as someone once put it when I was giving the talk of this, are you trying to take the piss out of all of us? Which the answer was yes. But the second, you know, the second thing was that it was designed to be, you know, sort of a supplementary textbook, which it's wound up being in a lot of intro to IR classes. When I was writing the book, I didn't have to do much research on international relations theory. I kind of knew that stuff. I had to do research on two other things, though. The first was the zombie genre, which I knew nothing about going into it. And so basically every night at about 10 o'clock after my kids went to bed, I would have to watch another zombie movie. And that, you know, wears on you after a while.
Which was your favorite?
Oh, my favorite? Shaun of the Dead, I think.
Really? You like that better than Night of the Living Dead?
Night of the Living Dead is extremely good. And Night of the Living Dead, you know, is the urtext of all of this.
Right.
But I guess I like Shaun of the Dead, among other things, because it offers a slightly more hopeful message, which we'll get to in a bit. But yeah, I mean, you know, I like Night of the Living Dead, Romero's original Dawn of the Dead. 28 Days Later is extremely good. But Shaun of the Dead is also a sly satire on the previous zombie films. And so in some ways it's, you know, as someone who likes meta stuff, I kind of like that.
All right. So I want to evaluate the performance of, this is meta. You were evaluating how different international relations theories would predict the world would respond to a zombie apocalypse as a way of evaluating different international relations theories. I want to evaluate the performance of your book, which is to say we have something a little bit like a zombie apocalypse going on now.
Right. And that, by the way, that's the second body of work I did research, which was how societies respond to disasters, pandemics, emergencies, and so on and so forth. That was the sort of closest parallel I could find.
Right. So how, like, have countries in fact responded to the coronavirus in a fashion that comports with the way your book said they would respond under different international relations theories to a zombie apocalypse?
Right. So to be fair, my book didn't take a position. I mean, you know, my book was a survey of very a lot of different approaches. And I think if you look at the way that states have responded to the novel coronavirus, what you wind up concluding is that actually systemic theories of international relations don't do terribly well. Neither realism nor liberalism nor constructivism necessarily offers a coherent explanation for how states have responded. Realism does slightly better, I think, than the other two. But what is striking to me in terms of looking at the different national responses is how actually the sort of domestic politics and bureaucratic politics approaches really do seem to clean up very well. That, you know, among other things, the model, the book predicted that authoritarian states would be less than transparent in terms of the information they provided about zombie outbreaks, because among other things, authoritarian states don't like to indicate that they are having issues because that represents an existential threat to their regime. And you've certainly seen that to the extent to which China has been less than fully transparent about the origins of COVID-19, as well as the degree to which they've actually affected, you know, the sort of casualty rates and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, it's not like democracies have done much better. And indeed, one of the things that I predicted would happen in democracies with the zombie apocalypse is there would be two contradictory trends that would wind up debilitating government responses. The first is that there would be a rally around the flag effect, that you would start, you know, you would see, you know, trust and leadership rise, you know, because you're responding to a crisis. The problem is that at that moment, leaders would also probably make significant mistakes because they would be encountering something novel. They would try to employ standard operating procedures, you know, try to reduce panic, and in the process, overly reassure publics. And then as things get worse, the public would grow to distrust authority at the exact moment when, paradoxically, bureaucracies would be moving down the learning curve in terms of figuring out how to handle this. And that's kind of played out exactly as we've seen it, which is you saw, you know, in the first phase of this, bureaucracy screwed up a fair amount. Both the CDC and FDA made significant mistakes. Trump constantly said, all is well, you know, this is all going to go away. And as things have gotten worse, you know, bureaucracies have gotten somewhat better at this. You know, you've seen ramps up, ramp ups in testing and you know, other sort of social distancing measures take effect. But at the same time, it was precisely that mistake that is going to cause significant distrust and disorganization in terms of the federal response.
So how is, to what extent is a coronavirus outbreak of this type the sort of thing that the zombie apocalypse is a metaphor for? Or to what extent are they different enough that the approach that you took in sort of imagining state response to a zombie apocalypse doesn't map on easily to novel coronavirus? Because I want to just point out some differences to start with. Coronavirus does not eat your flesh. It's not necrotizing fasciitis. It destroys lung function. And so you do, like the bodies do emerge with flesh.
Yes. So, I mean, the most obvious difference, and I've had to say this on occasion when I've previously talked about this, is to point this out, is that, I mean, there are two significant differences. The first is that in most of the zombie genre, the zombie infection rate, the R-naught, is like 100. You know, anyone who gets exposed to it gets infected.
There's no flattening the curve.
Right. There's no flattening the curve in terms of exposure to, you know, whatever zombie pathogen there is. And the second obvious difference is that once you get infected with the zombie pathogen, the effectiveness is 100%. You become a zombie, you know, with a few exceptions in some of the genre. Whereas clearly with COVID-19, you know, the R-naught is much lower, although it's still a highly infectious disease. And more importantly, most people, you know, even in the more dire forecast, you know, the reason we're talking about flattening the curve is not because the fatality rate of COVID-19 is, you know, on a par with Ebola or other kinds of hemorrhagic fevers. It's because you don't want everyone to get sick at the exact same time. And that's what overloads public health services. So eventually there's going to emerge a population that will have had the coronavirus and at least have some temporary immunity to it, which means they can therefore contribute to the public good rather than eat your family members.
Right. So another key difference, it seems to me, is that social distancing does not work with zombies, whereas it appears to work with coronavirus, right? So the zombies actively chase you, whereas if you keep enough distance, it's not that aggressive in like personally seeking you out to get you.
See, this gets to where like there are variations within the zombie genre. You know, if you're talking about the fast zombies, a la 28 Days Later, yeah, you're right. Social distancing ain't going to work. They're going to come everywhere. You know, if you're talking about the Romero-style zombies, you know, the sort of, slow walkers, it's possible social distancing would help some. The question then becomes, you know, what draws zombies close to you? Some people suggest it's sound. Some people just suggest they're, you know, they can detect, you know, live human flesh. And you know, these are deep metaphysical questions that I'm not entirely sure your viewers care about.
All right. So let's turn from there to your most recent book, which is about presidential leadership, which is another subject that the current environment just kind of solidly puts on the table. I submit that if there were a Nobel Prize in literature awarded for Twitter threads, this would be the hands down first winner. It is the greatest, most important Twitter thread composed by anybody on any subject. How many elements does it have now?
At last count, we are at 1,298 instances.
And is this the first Twitter thread that has ever been published in hardcover by a major university press?
I have to think the answer is yes. I mean, I haven't, you know, exhaustively surveyed, but I think the university press part is the clincher.
Yeah, I mean, like, again, if the Nobel Committee is thinking about opening up, like, there's really no competition. It's 1,200 plus and published by the University of Chicago Press, right?
Right. So, and in fact, actually, the one of the reasons I went with the University of Chicago Press is because my editor there, Chuck Myers, was actually my editor for the zombie book when I published that book at Princeton. And he really did a great job of sort of, you know, getting me to get the tone of the book right, because I'd hit a couple stumbling blocks. So in some ways, this is a similar kind of project because it obviously kind of walks the line between humor and horror, as it were. And so I thought that Chuck would be appropriate to edit this as well.
And it also has its humor and horror with a serious political science bent to it.
Yes. So I confess that this is what I would refer to as the Stone Soup of books, in that when I first had the idea, what I thought I would do would be, oh, this will be simple. I'll write a very quickie intro and I'll write a quickie conclusion and it'll just be the tweets in between and I won't have to do that much. And so much like, you know, the two villagers who go in and say, oh, we can make a soup with just stones, and everyone else adds something to the broth. As it turned out, I added about 65,000 words, you know, within the span of as I was writing this. And the book makes two arguments. One is the toddler argument. It basically says that, you know, by any normal conventional definition of toddler traits, Donald Trump actually has a lot of them. He displays temper tantrums. He has short attention span. He has poor impulse control. He displays oppositional behavior. He doesn't know a lot. He has a problem with addiction to screens and so on and so forth. The more serious political science argument is that this is a bigger problem than it would have been even during the height of the Cold War, because essentially the checks and balances on the presidency have eroded badly in, let's say, the 45 years since Watergate. And this might be where we somewhat disagree at times, but, you know, essentially that, you know, congressional and judicial checks on the executive branch have eroded. Constraints within the executive branch, both formal and informal, have also eroded. And the sort of norms that the sort of informal institutions, the sort of proper way or the way we expect the president to behave have also eroded badly. Most of this, by the way, taking place long before Donald Trump was inaugurated as president. So, you know, he's expanded presidential power in some ways, but he's done so because he's been sitting on an office that was designed over decades to be occupied by the last grown-up in Washington, D.C., and then unfortunately we elected Donald Trump.
All right, so let's back up and go to the beginning of the toddler-in-chief thread, I believe in April of 2017, if mm-hmm. memory serves.
Yes.
How did it start? Tell us the story.
Well, it started unintentionally. So what I do think you have to remember, I know it's been eons ago, you know, when you go back to early 2017, but you have to remember, and you saw this if you were paying any attention whatsoever to the mainstream media, that there was this aching desire by a lot of commentators to argue that Donald Trump was going to grow into the presidency, that essentially the office would make the man rather than vice versa, and that there would be this welter of checks and constraints and ensure that Donald Trump would you know, recognize the gravity of what he was about to be doing. And this led in the first couple of months to commentators like Van Jones or Fareed Zakaria. You know, if Trump did anything that seemed halfway adult-like, like consider his first joint address to Congress or his address to the nation when he launched missile strikes in Syria after the chemical weapons attack. You know, after the joint address to Congress, Van Jones said, you know, this was the day that Donald Trump became president. And Fareed Zakaria, you know, after the Syrian address, said, this is the day that Donald Trump became president. And, you know, it just struck me there was this cognitive dissonance between these commentators desperately trying to argue that Trump was growing into the office, and yet news story after news story of Trump's own supporters and staffers describing him the way you would describe the most petulant two-year-old in history. And so in late April of 2017, there was a story by Robert Costa and Ashley Parker in the Washington Post in which they were describing Trump's addiction to television. And a staffer, anonymously, obviously, you know, told Costa and Parker, you know, something along the lines of, once he goes upstairs to the East Wing, there's no controlling him. And I just sort of thought, that's how you would describe like a rambunctious toddler that you sent upstairs. And so it was an offhand comment of, you know, I'll believe that Trump is growing into the presidency when his staff stops talking about him like a toddler. And when I tweeted it, I didn't really think anything. It was just sort of it was pure snark. Except that then, you know, I then saw another story about a day or two later in Politico that essentially had a quote from a staffer that described him the exact same way. It said something along the lines of, he just seemed to go crazy today, you know, which is, again, how you would describe a bad two-year-old's time at a daycare facility. And then a couple days later, there was an Axios story in which, you know, Trump's White House staffers just, you know, said they felt like Montessori preschool teachers. And so I started threading the tweet, and I really didn't think it was going to go anywhere. I was just sort of a theme that I was, you know, making. And I didn't realize just how much legs it had. I think the moment I realized when it had legs was, if you remember, there was a Time magazine cover story in May of 2017. I think it was May, about what Trump's life was like in the White House. And it described, among other things, you know, Trump having dinner with Vice President Mike Pence, and, you know, it's sort of normal dinner that he would have with other high-ranking Trump officials, in which, among other things, when dessert was served, everyone got one scoop of ice cream, but Trump got two scoops of ice cream and chocolate sauce. And I read that and thought, that is the most toddler move ever, you know.
I get more ice cream than you.
Yes, exactly. You know, and I do want to stress that you know, occasionally I get pushback about this metaphor, saying that I'm being mean to toddlers when I do this. And I'm very explicit in the book in saying that when I'm analogizing with toddlers, I'm relying on two things. The first is, I do rely on the American Academy of Pediatrics guide to raising toddlers, and, like, you know, cite them in terms of how they describe toddler behavior, because it fits Trump perfectly. But the second thing I try to point out is that the difference between Trump and an actual toddler, this is an analogy, it breaks down at some point. And the reason it breaks down is that toddlers grow up. They're behaving the way they're behaving because they have limited cognitive capacities to deal with the world. And so if they pitch a fit, it's their way of trying to signal what's going on. Trump, believe it or not, despite the nature of the threat, I don't think is going to grow into the presidency.
Yeah. So when did you realize that this was a long-term project, that you were, you know, that the thread was not going to be 3 or 4 or 15, but that you were going to document the toddler-in-chief idea until the end of time?
Well, when you put it like that, it sounds somewhat depressing. I guess the answer is that, you know, one of the things I've been struck by during the Trump years has been the difficulty in many ways in which, you know, folks in our profession, and by that I mean public intellectuals and commentators and so on and so forth, have tried to characterize Trump. There's a thing that a colleague of mine, Dan Nexon at Georgetown, once described as analytical normalization, which means if you try to describe the Trump administration the way you would using normal standard political science models, it normalizes Trump in a way that actually doesn't really work, because he really is truly unique. And so I began to realize that the toddler thread worked in no small part because it points out the ways in which Trump is unique as a leader. And really, you'd have to, you know, if you look at sort of past presidents, there are aspects of his behavior that you can see in others. You know, think of Andrew Johnson's temper or Andrew Jackson's volatility. They're all negative character traits, essentially, of past presidents. But I thought that the value of the toddler thread was, again, to point out that this isn't a normal presidency by any stretch of the imagination, and that you really do need to rely on what in international relations we would describe as the first image, sort of individual level, psychology-based, cognitive-based explanations for behavior. And I think the moment I realized I would probably try to write a book out of it was there was a story that I think Annie Carney wrote in Politico about Trump's tendency to rip up paper. That if Trump, you know, read a memo or, you know, actually did some of his assigned reading and did what he was supposed to do, he would rip up the piece of paper sort of as a way to demonstrate that it was done. And of course, this violates the Presidential Records Act. So it's an illegal thing to do. So as a result, the White House actually had to task a document management team to literally tape together the documents that Trump rips up. And so I realized that that was something to write about, because first, it's just a bizarre aspect of this. But the other thing is it points out the ways in which the White House and the federal government have had to adjust what they do to accommodate the fact that the president of the United States has the intellectual maturity of a 3-year-old.
All right. So
what does the book do that you can't get from scrolling through the 1,200 tweets? I mean, I have to say, as you know, but the audience doesn't, I read this book in draft to give you comments on, and I was interested, first of all, in the sort of analytic framework that you set up, but also there's this thing about the thread that it is just kind of overwhelming in its in its disorganized sequential, I mean overwhelmingness, right? It's just and that actually doesn't come through in the book in the same way, because the book is it is organized and just sort of doesn't have the feel of life crashing over you or the presidency crashing over you like a wave, but yet the organization does do a lot. So talk us through what the idea was when you said, I'm going to take this thing that was raw data generated by me in real time, me and the press in real time, and turn it into a framework for the University of Chicago.
So the way I went about it was, because you're right, the first of all, the Twitter's threads functionality is occasionally questionable. I mean, you know, we're talking about 1,300 tweets. It's not easy to actually scroll through all of them. The way I wound up organizing it is sort of twofold. First, the sort of the heavy duty political science, as it were, or the sort of politics of it, are primarily in the introduction and the last two chapters. So, you know, even if you don't buy the shtick of the toddler thread, you could actually read, you know, the first 30 pages and last 50 pages of the book, and it reads essentially like a standard, you know, close to a standard political science text in terms of describing sort of changes in American politics that have caused Trump to be able to do what he's doing. So that's one thing. The other thing I did was, you know, when I decided I was going to try to, you know, see how far the analogy worked, you know, when I developed the thread, I mean, this was based, you know, you're a parent, I'm a parent, we both raised toddlers, we kind of know it, you know, I was applying a Potter Stewart, know it when I see it aspect to Trump's behavior. But, you know, when I was to write a scholarly book, that's not enough. And so I actually did read the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines for raising children and reading like the 2-year-old chapter, the 3-year-old chapter, the 4-year-old chapter. Fun fact here, when I started doing that, and this probably demonstrates the bad parenting I did when I actually had small children, my wife's reaction to this was, oh, this is what causes you to read this stuff? when we had small children, you know, my wife being a good professional middle-class woman, you know, bought a ton of these books and was like trying to read them to try to figure out what was going on with our toddler. She would occasionally say, hey, this is really useful. And I'd be like, you know, retrograde father.
You were too busy reading about zombies.
Exactly. Yes. So, but as it turned out, if I was doing it for research, I would actually be able to read this book. And the striking thing when I was reading it was, A, realizing that, in fact, the portions of that manual that applied best to Trump were not the stuff about 4-year-olds or 3-year-olds, but was the stuff about 2-year-olds. And B, being able, and then sort of reading a little more of the developmental psychology literature, the book is organized by specific toddler traits. So there's a chapter on Trump's temper tantrums. There's a chapter on Trump's short attention span and why that's a problem. A chapter on Trump's poor impulse control, how his knowledge deficits compromise his presidency. And in some ways, each of the chapters is also sort of organized in a two-part way, I guess. The first is to demonstrate conclusively that Trump actually displays this trait. But then second, why that's a problem. And there I can sort of rely on both sort of standard political science, you know, literature, particularly the political psychology literature, and also the ways in which it makes staffing Trump that much harder than it would be to staff a normal president. And it's not even easy to staff a normal president. But the sort of Herculean tasks required to, let's say, properly brief a president who doesn't know anything and can't sit still for more than 10 minutes is that much harder than, let's say, staffing a person like George W. Bush or Barack Obama. And so I think that's actually one of the unheralded explanations, by the way, for the high rate of staff turnover within the Trump administration. It's not just that Trump finds people disloyal, it's that I think these people eventually just get sick of it.
So talk a little bit about the organization of the book. You said you've organized it by toddler traits. There was a feature of the original thread that I thought was both very important and actually disciplining, which is you were not including in the thread when people like me compared right. the president to a toddler. Only people who had kind of rooting interests in the president's success could make it into the toddler in chief thread. And so I'm interested in as much detail as you can spell out. What are the methodological rules of the toddler in chief thread? And then what are the additional layers of analysis that you added, or organization and analysis that you added in the book?
Right. So to be included in the toddler in chief thread, there had to be a couple of criteria met. The first was that the reporting had to be a reliable source, a reliable sort of, media outlet, or someone that I would have, trusted. So, we're primarily talking about the Washington Post, the New York Times, Politico, and so on and so forth. There are plenty of others that I've cited, but, generally speaking, I was not, taking anything from, InfoWars or, more dubious outlets like that. The second thing was, is that the person describing, or there had to be something attributed to a Trump ally, whether it was a White House staffer or a GOP Hill official or a GOP senator or representative or an international treaty ally or a cabinet official or something like that, someone who would have a rooting interest in the president succeeding, nonetheless describing him the way you would describe a toddler. It became easier to look out for these things once I started thinking about the book, because then I sort of realized the sort of traits and markers I was looking for in terms of, did Trump, lose his temper? Okay, we'll add that. Did Trump show an aversion to new foods? Yep, we'll add that. Did Trump travel badly, that he wouldn't go to sleep? Things like that.
And Dan, just to be clear, are you collecting these chiefly yourself, as in scouring every article in the political press every day for toddler-like behaviors in the president? Or are people sending you this stuff? And how inclusive is the thread? I mean, what percentage of toddler-in-chief eligible examples do you estimate are included in the sample?
So to answer your second question first, it's always tough to know. I'm sure, I have no doubt there are things I have missed, because again, this is a one person operation. I didn't even have a research assistant in terms of writing this book. I did things like take vacations at times, or once a quarter take a Twitter siesta to sort of recenter my mental health. And so in those instances, I'm sure I missed things. And I'm sure I missed other stories, because bear in mind, I didn't start this until late April of 2017. I missed 3 months. Yeah, 3 months of toddler behavior at the outset. So I don't have any doubt that, like, my coverage, if I was going to ballpark it, my guess is I'm getting maybe 2/3 of the actual toddler stuff. Because also, bear in mind, I'm sure he behaves even more like a toddler. But again, someone's got to tell a reporter this. That said, in terms of how I'm collecting this, it's sort of a mixture of police patrols and fire alarms. So the police patrol part is me actively looking for this stuff. And, because I'm on Twitter, I've now gotten to the point where I can usually, like, even just looking at the headline of a story, tell, oh, okay, they're going to describe Trump's behavior here. There's a decent chance there's going to be a toddler entry. I'll scan the story, and if I see something, then it'll get added to the thread. That said, one of the advantages is that as the thread gained notoriety is that I would have people alert me. And by the way, this includes occasionally a reporter, would DM me saying, I think this is good for the thread. So, there have been times where I might have missed something, but then someone, clues me into, hey, this story works. Can you add it? And to be fair, sometimes I can't, because, like, it's because Pelosi said it as opposed to, let's say Kevin McCarthy. And I can't, by the rules, I can't add that to the thread. But very often they're catching things that I would potentially have missed because it's, let's say, coming from a source that I don't regularly check, like, Business Insider as opposed to Politico. And so, as a result, I think over the years, the coverage has probably gotten better.
And so what then is the additional analytic layer beyond organizing it by traits of toddlers that you've done in the book.
I think what the book does is not, again, it's not just catalog as behavior, although I obviously do that. I think it also, what it tries to do is catalog two things. First, the effects of his behavior. In other words, how as a result has the federal government had to cope with this? And in particular, you know, his White House staff, you know, political appointees, and for that matter, sort of, you know, the permanent bureaucracy as well. And the answer is that they've not necessarily always coped with it well. And the second thing to point that the book does, I think, is sort of highlight, in some ways, Trump is an extreme example of sort of bad leadership. And it raises the question of how do we then therefore evaluate the presidency as an institution? What should we take away from this? And, you know, certainly one of the arguments I make in the book is that if there's anything else we've learned from this, is that we need to childproof the presidency. Because if Trump heralds, you know, a sort of new generation of, you know, more populist politicians or politicians whose immature leadership actually resonates with a large, you know, portion of the American public, then we got to make sure that, you know, if the president's going to do something, he's doing something that is, you know, okay with the Constitution and not just sort of running roughshod over other branches of government.
And in your view, as you look at the toddler-in-chief behavior set, what are the key, I'm trying to think of a good set of metaphors for child-proofing, the outlet plug guards or the toilet seat locks that we should add to the president?
The way I would put it is, think about the child-proof, you know, aspirin caps.
Okay, I'm thinking about it. Like, if you were making policy now, what does the childproof aspirin cap for the presidency look like?
What it would look like, presumably, are procedural steps that presumably any adult president would not have difficulty surmounting, but would actually be difficult for a immature president to be able to accomplish. And so, or that would, you know, or would be checked by it. So, you know, I think in some ways, for example, the role of inspectors general within the executive branch as a way of sort of checking, you know, presidential abuse of power. Or, you know, if he wants to exercise emergency powers, the idea that Congress would have to, you know, sign on to it as a way of, you know, ensuring that this is not just sort of the whims of a particular leader. So the hope is that what you'd want would be not to do things that would excessively constrain the president, because you do want a reasonably strong presidency. There are arguments in favor of that. You know, you go back to the Federalists and so on and so forth. But in some ways, the book's conclusion is that this is not just on the president. It's also part of the reason we got to this point is that the other political institutions that we rely on have in some ways become more immature. That part of the reason the president has so much power is that polarization is incapacitated and rendered Congress dysfunctional. And so Congress needs to grow the hell up as well. And for that matter, you know, while I'm at it, the American people. You can't really blame the American people for Donald Trump winning in 2016, since he didn't win a plurality of the vote. But obviously, you know, in 2020, another choice, another possibility comes up. And yeah, I think the last sentence in the book is that if you know, Donald Trump gets reelected, the biggest toddler in America is not Donald Trump. The toddlers are us.
We're going to leave it there. The book is The Toddler in Chief, What Donald Trump Teaches Us About the Modern Presidency. The author is the wonderfully eccentric Daniel Dresner, whom, if you are not following on Twitter, if this podcast stands for anything, it is that you should be. Dan, stay safe and healthy, and let's do this again sometime soon.
Looking forward to it. Looking forward to, at some point post-apocalypse, seeing you in person.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to our new recording engineers, the folks at Goat Rodeo, who will be taking over our audio engineering from here on in.
you should support the Lawfare podcast by doing all the social media things, you know, tweeting, Facebook sharing, Instagram, whatever you do on Instagram, and Reddit. I want more Reddit coverage of the Lawfare podcast. The Lawfare podcast is recorded by Goat Rodeo. It is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.